Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, what happened during the creation and growth of Mars Hill Church made waves in Seattle and beyond. A charismatic minister, Mark Driscoll, preached in a daring new way. He sought to make his ministry culturally relevant, bringing a hipster attitude to conservative theology. His methods drew people to the church in growing numbers. But it turned out the foundation of the church was unsound. Driscoll was criticized from within the ranks of his colleagues and followers. Accusations against him included misogyny, plagiarism, emotional manipulation, and abuse of authority. In 2014, Driscoll was forced to resign from the organization he'd built. Soon after, the church that had grown to 15 facilities in 5 states disbanded. At the time this rise and fall was taking place, an anthropologist named Jessica Johnson embedded herself within the church. She gained access to leaders and congregants and made a thorough study of what was taking place from the top down. The result is her book, Biblical Porn: Affect, Labor, and Pastor Mark Driscoll's Evangelical Empire. Johnson teaches in the departments of anthropology and gender, women, and sexuality studies at the University of Washington. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23rd. KUOW's Sonia Harris recorded her talk. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this recording contains themes of an adult nature.
Thank you all so much for coming. I very much appreciate it. By the summer of 2014, evidence had surfaced online supporting several allegations against Pastor Mark Driscoll of Mars Hill Church. These charges included the use of a marketing scheme to achieve best-selling status for Driscoll's 2012 book, Real Marriage, as well as tactics of bullying, micromanagement, and shunning used to suppress information and stifle dissent. After former leaders posted confessions seeking repentance for sinning as and being sinned against church authority, a protest was organized outside the main facility, which had shifted from Seattle to suburban Bellevue. Although it is highly unusual for Christians to publicly demonstrate outside a church against the mishandling of administrative and spiritual matters, it was not my first experience standing among protesters a stone's throw from Mars Hill's parking lot. Driving past the suburban facility where Driscoll now spent Sundays, in a mall complex sprawling with buildings so uniform it was easy to lose a sense of space entirely, I tried to imagine what sermons in the beige faux cathedral, planted next to an equally looming yet non-distinct Barnes & Noble, would feel like by comparison to those I had attended from 2006 to 2008 in a renovated hardware warehouse in Ballard. While the issues cleverly summarized in colorful slogans on placards raised important questions, it was a 30-minute video posted to the Mars Hill website that inspired ex-staff and congregants to mobilize behind the rally cry, "We are not anonymous." This performance began with Driscoll sitting down in a simple wooden chair in the imposing Bellevue sanctuary, his figure flanked by rows of empty seats rather than large screens, the pulpit lectern on stage out of focus behind his left shoulder. The camera angle was such that it felt as though Driscoll was facing me from where I sat, with laptop open at my desk. His complexion was ruddy but grizzled with salt and pepper stubble. The only prop that appeared throughout his delivery was a leather-bound Bible, which he physically and verbally gestured with and to in the video's opening moments. "Hi, Mars Hill, Pastor Mark here. I wanted to give you a bit of an update on the season that we have been in and continue to be in. And I was thinking about it, and when I was 17 years of age, Jesus gave me this Bible through a gal named Grace, who is of course now my wife. And Jesus saved me when I was 19 in college as a freshman, reading this Bible. And I started opening this Bible when I was nearly 25, and Grace and I were a young married couple in our rental home. We felt called to start Mars Hill Church, and so we would have some people over for a Bible study. And there were not a lot of people, so we didn't have a full service. Instead, I would sit in this chair, and I would open this Bible, and just teach to a handful of people, or a few handfuls of people that would show up in our living room. And that grew to be Mars Hill Church. Now that I'm 43, almost 44, looking back, it's overwhelming if I'm honest. It's shocking and amazing and staggering and wonderful. What Jesus has done has far exceeded even what I was praying for or hoping for or dreaming of. After this introduction, littered with references to the Bible in his hands, a material manifestation of God's hand in Mars Hill's successful growth, as well as his own spiritual authority, Driscoll explained that the purpose of this video was to communicate in a way that was godly by directly addressing congregants in a manner that was intended as a means of loving you and informing you. Within the first 5 minutes of this performance, publicly disseminated online, yet purportedly broadcast for an audience of intimates, Driscoll made the statement that many I later spoke with attributed with triggering the protest. During this season as well, I've been rather silent, and there are some reasons for that. First of all, we, including myself, needed to determine what exactly was happening. If I'm real honest with you, at first it was just a little overwhelming and a bit confusing. As well, one of the things that has been complex is the fact that a lot of people we are dealing with in this season remain anonymous. And so we don't know how to reconcile or how to work things out with people because we're not entirely sure who they are. And so that has made things a little more complex and difficult as well. Stunned, I looked at my browser loaded with tabs open to sites with names such as Joyful Exiles, Repentant Pastor, Mars Hill Refuge, and We Love Mars Hill, with multiple testimonies to spiritual, emotional, and financial exploitation were posted with the author's name clearly identified. My initial sense of betrayal seemed unreasonable, given I had no personal attachment to any of the people in these stories, had not seen Driscoll preach live for years, and had never considered him an authority figure, given I did not and never have self-identified as a Christian. I was not the video's intended audience. There was no rationalization, let alone words, for how I felt. I was not physically shaken as I watched Driscoll lie to my face through the computer screen, but my agitation was palpable and did not recede during the entirety of his message. Even more disconcertingly, I found myself not only hoping but also believing that he was going to change course and repent of his sin, as he had admonished audiences repeatedly and vehemently to do. I kept waiting for an acknowledgement of the specific charges of abuse and the suffering of those who had had the courage to openly testify to their prolonged spiritual and psychological toll. When that did not happen, instead of doubting Driscoll, I started wondering if I had misheard or misunderstood. In a sense, I kept the faith alive until the final minutes of his message. Lastly, many of you have asked myself and other leaders, how can we be in prayer? I genuinely appreciate that. I would say, pray for your local leaders. They're dealing with things that I'm not dealing with. And there are some things in this season that are they're strange, unique. For example, at one of our churches, someone is folding up pornography and putting it in our pew Bibles. Just all kinds of things in this strange season. So that when the lead pastor gets up and says, hey, if you're new or not a Christian, we've got some free Bibles in the pew. Feel free to pick one up and go to page whatever for the sermon. And they open it up and they're exposed to pornography. And this can be adults or children. And so now there's a team having to go through our Bibles and take the pornography out to make sure their Bibles are clean on Sundays. The working title of my book on the church had been Biblical Porn for a couple of years. I was also in the process of writing a chapter on spiritual warfare, and never was my sense of it so keen as I unexpectedly burst out laughing at the story's end. It was a full-body laugh that erupted from my gut and lasted for a long time, but not because I found the act of vandalism described particularly funny. After all the lies I had listened to, I highly doubted the authenticity of this anecdote, but that did not make it any less affective. The definition of affect taken up by many political theorists, among them Brian Massumi, is the power to affect and to be affected. Massumi writes, writing through affect is not just reflecting on it, it is thought taking the plunge. A process of change that is the first stirrings of the political, flush with the felt intensities of life. The empirical examination of affect complicates distinctions between macro and micro power, what philosophers Gil Deleuze and Felix Guattari call the microphysics of desire. In anthropological theory, William Mazzarella considers affect as carrying tactile, sensuous, and perhaps even involuntary connotations, implying a way of apprehending social life that does not start with the bounded intentional subject, while at the same time foregrounding embodiment and sensuous life. As Mazzarella's formulation suggests, affect is difficult to explain to analyze by conventional discourse discursive methods, given it is radically grounded in the body to the extent that it cannot be articulated or rendered immediately intelligible in language. Thus, the clunky hyphenet used by anthropologists to describe ethnographic fieldwork, participant observation, becomes usefully troubled in the examination of affect. Participant observation does not occur in the field. It is of the field. Laughter is such a field. Philosopher William Conley describes laughter as a manifestation of surplus affect that can trigger side perceptions at odds with the dominant drift of perception and interpretation, such that the flow of thought is interrupted to open up a window of creativity. It was not what Marx said that made me laugh, but the sense that we were sharing an inside joke. This surplus affective value did not register in his rhetoric, reside in a commodity, or remain self-contained, but manifested as conviction so unfocused it emitted both within and without me. In this circulation of what feminist theorist Sarah Ahmed posits as an affective economy, emotions play a crucial role in the surfacing of individual and collective bodies to the ways in which emotions circulate between bodies and signs. After the video ended, I sought to interpret and identify what I was feeling in emotional terms and settled on paranoia, figuring this irrational response would quickly subside. After all, Marx's employ of hyperbole and humor to excite and seduce audiences were renowned and considered among his gifts and strengths as a communicator. However, rather than fading, the intensity and unpredictability of sensations impossible to pin down kept me awake nights and indoors at my desk, scanning the internet for the unknown and unknowable. Information, affirmation, safety, and from whom or what exactly? At first, I rationalized my feelings in terms that I could understand and articulate as a feminist anthropologist, social justice. Put simply, I desired recognition for those whose suffering went unacknowledged. Despite its good intentions, such an explanation was no excuse for the disturbing and overpowering need I had to do something without knowing what that could be, other than endlessly tracking the explosion of media coverage surrounding Driscoll and the church. While Marx's opening posture and closing story provided the perfect tactile validation for my book's title, beyond anything I could ever dream or script, it was not until I asked permission to join the protest with former Mars Hill members via a public Facebook page entitled We Are Not Anonymous that its affective value became clearer. I had come under conviction, but not of my own sinful nature and need for salvation. I did not become born again in Christian terms, but I had to confront the troubling reality that I had desired to believe in Pastor Mark. This was a desire that I did not feel I deserved, nor frankly wished to own, given I had never sacrificed for the church, nor ideologically seen eye to eye with Driscoll. That video haunted me with surplus affect, both possessed and inhabited, that was not truly mine. In the frantic days after watching the video, I found a link to the public Facebook group We Are Not Anonymous. Without forethought or script, I woke up one morning and wrote a former church leader that I had not met. I'm writing for your thoughts on the question of whether my presence would be welcome at the protest this Sunday. I've been reluctant to join anything that would make anyone uncomfortable, especially as I'm a non-Christian. I'm in a strange limbo state where I'm not an insider, but not really an outsider either. And it's hard for me to simply watch from the sidelines with all that's happened. I never admitted that I was not a Christian or pretended to be anything but a feminist anthropologist. Openly informing those I spoke with of my identity was ethical according to my methodological training. Yet positionality was inadequate to the task of explaining my prolonged experience of liminality and displacement, a process through which I came to affectively, if not theologically, resonate with former church members. To claim any positionality in my case was feeble, a hollow gesture and ideological fiction in the face of sociality generated out of a disaggregation of self. This affective process of coming under conviction online was underway prior to 2014 and ongoing after the video's end, compelling my inquiry into distinctions between the human and non-human, materiality and discourse, as well as the boundaries constituted and policed by the categories religious and secular. Language was not the catalyst for religious conversion. Instead, an intensification of my body's relation to itself occurred in an event encounter with other bodies, an assemblage of materialities that included Driscoll, his Bible, my laptop screen, tabs open to websites dedicated to former congregants' testimonies, and the supposed prankster putting pornography into pew Bibles. All of these bodies were affective conductors, rendering my positionality arbitrary. As I watched the video, I had no language for what I was experiencing. I could not discern divine providence or impose self-will and explanations for what was bodily unfolding. I did not ask why I wanted to believe Mark would repent to the extent that I even doubted myself, as there were no religious or personal reasons for such an investment. Instead, I kept asking how. When I described my experience of coming under conviction during the anonymous video to a former leader, how I trusted Mark would repent to the extent that I questioned myself, he emphatically gestured to my phone on the table as it was recording our conversation and exclaimed, "Put that down, get that in." At the wooden table where we sat, I was not the only one taking notes. I used pen and paper, he used a tablet. I'd asked permission to record our time together, an interview that lasted nearly 6 hours. And whenever there needed to be a pause, he would double check to see if we were recording again. Many of those I spoke with did not want to be recorded or have their names used. I understood. It was risky. I was asking people who had been socially isolated out of fear of being labeled gossips or divisive to discuss events that could be read as indictments of themselves and or others, some of whom were family members or friends that remained connected to Mars Hill after they left. I asked people where they wanted to meet so they could choose whether they would be more comfortable talking at home or in public. In one Seattle coffee shop in the vicinity of a Mars Hill facility before the church officially disbanded, a former pastor spent much of our 30 minutes together glancing around the premises, informing me when someone associated with the church walked in, eyes darting and brow lightly beaded with sweat. In one home, tears surfaced in the eyes of an ex-pastor as soon as we sat down. Later during our conversation, tears welled up in mine. Many confessed that they had felt duped and betrayed as well as culpable. There was a tension between what was attributable to human will and what was attributable to divine will, individual agency, and God's sovereignty. People were not only looking to answer, but also to find answers themselves. None of my interviews with former church staff were a one-way affair. I played informant too, describing the arguments of my book, experiences at Mars Hill, and fluctuating feelings in the aftermath of its dissolution. From 1996 to 2014, the church multiplied into 15 facilities in 5 U.S. states, serving approximately 13,000 attendees as Driscoll's preaching on biblical oral sex earned him international celebrity. In sermons such as The Porn Path and an e-book called Porn Again Christian, Driscoll stated in no uncertain terms that free and frequent sex between a husband and wife is necessary to assure fidelity within Christian marriages and secure masculine leadership within evangelical churches. "Our world assaults men with images of beautiful women," he warned. "Male brains house an ever-growing repository of lustful snapshots, always on random shuffle. The temptation to sin by viewing porn and other visual lures is an everyday war." As Driscoll claimed, sometimes pornography is in an image, sometimes it is in your imagination. His sexualized hermeneutic revealed women's body parts cloaked in biblical metaphor. Meanwhile, question and answer sessions during services encouraged congregants to text queries that materialized as soundbite confessions to sins and desires on large screens surrounding Mars Hill's sanctuary. The church's employ of visual and digital media served to amplify Driscoll's sermonizing on sex by conscripting audience participation and animating a pornographic imaginary that legitimized his spiritual authority. Biblical porn constituted Mars Hill congregants as gender-specific sexual agents and sinners who were trained to embody biblical masculinity, femininity, and sexuality. However, the affective labor of biblical porn also recruited and perpetuated bodily work and processes that were non-intentional, mobilizing conviction in calibrated and uncontrollable ways that were not always pleasurable or intelligible. My use of affective labor builds on Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's theorization. contact that can be either actual or virtual, care entirely immersed in the corporeal, while the effects it produces are immaterial, social networks, forms of community, biopower. In theorizing biblical porn as affective labor, I signal the critical potential of examining porn not simply as image or text, but also as imaginary and industry, or more precisely, imaginary as industry. At Mars Hill, such affective labor entailed a variety of service opportunities that primed the church's atmosphere and fostered networks of care, such as worship band, media production, security team, and children's ministry. In addition, affective labor was enlisted through inadvertent yet habituated visceral responses, gut feelings, belly laughs, glances, and gestures that excited, agitated, and exploited a desire to believe. The orchestration of this affective labor was articulated in terms of air war and ground war, with the aim to rally 1,000 churches behind one pulpit. As Mars Hill's facilities multiplied, imperatives to support the church's propagation were framed in violent terms of combat readiness and the sexualized embodiment of visual generosity and sexual freedom by Christian wives. The theology of sex prescribed by Driscoll as biblical generated an evangelical genre of social pornography that was contingent on the free industry of congregants who contributed to its production, distribution, and diffusion. Practices of confession and processes of imagination were mediated and networked via nervous systems and fiber optics. In turn, fear, shame, and paranoia circulated within and well beyond Mars Hill's facilities as political and economic value that extended beyond the monitoring and management of normatively biblical gender and sexuality, generating the social conviction and self-sacrifice necessary for Mars Hill's ongoing expansion beyond reason or resources, against the moral conscience of leaders, financial capacity of the church, and manpower available at local facilities. Precarity intensified as locations multiplied and congregants were increasingly exposed to risk in spiritual, emotional, and material ways, a constant sense of insecurity that infused the very constitution of work. During his 2008 sermon series on the Song of Songs entitled The Peasant Princess, Driscoll sermonized center stage while a background scrim of images shifted according to emotional register. A pastor blogging about the creative team's approach to the branding of The Peasant Princess wrote, "We knew that Pastor Mark would be preaching through the Song of Songs well in advance of the September launch date, but the direction he would take and the best way to support the sermon visually and conceptually were not as clear as we would have liked. Going into the time of the greatest growth potential for a church, the fall, we wanted to make sure we took full advantage of college kids starting school and summer vacations ending. Knowing that Song of Songs would be a drawing sermon, we first began working on a sermon series branding that centered on the concept of free sex. We went with this title and began working on visual concepts for about 3 weeks before we found out the name was changed to Free Love to try and tone down the in-your-face title we previously had. The idea was Vegas 2050 meets Disney meets Mars Hill. To bring this free love theme to life, Mars Hill's production staff created an animated video introduction for the Princess series. The film's visuals mimicked Disney's doe-eyed characters and bright techno colors, while updating this template so that its color scheme reflected the techno-infused electronic keyboards pulsating in the background. A catchy bubblegum pop vibe with a pronounced bass beat that encouraged head bobbing. Green and yellow birds cavorted with a pink deer bounding across a bright meadow where a chesty, grinning apple tree with well-defined pectoral muscles gyrated to the music. The Peasant Princess video invited viewers to participate in its pastoral, family-friendly scene, offering a setting that was playfully coy. Frolicking fawns winked at the audience, signifying biblical sex as pure, lighthearted fun. The flirtatious deer in the video were inspired by biblical imagery that, according to Pastor Mark, signified breasts. The petting zoo is now open, he exclaimed in week 7 of the series, while the well-endowed apple tree was a metaphorical stand-in for oral sex. As the illustrated characters of this animated short conjured visions of Disney characters, Pastor Mark and his congregants fueled fantasies of Vegas 2050. Driscoll preached in front of a glowing cross as a background screen of large tube light bulbs in neon blue, green, red, orange, and yellow, oscillated like a Rorschach light bright. The cross, pulpit, and TV frame set pieces were handmade and wired by a deacon and his wife. with each capable of displaying over 200,000 different colors. As Pastor Mark sermonized, the flashing hues served to highlight the tenor of his voice and tone of his message, which hewed closer to the original theme of free sex than free love. This focus on how to embody biblical sexuality for the health of marriages as well as the church afforded the perfect platform through which to encourage congregants to openly confess and regularly repent of their sexual sin for the sake of Mars Hill's security and legacy. In week 7, Driscoll preached on verses he deemed the most erotic, exotic, and exciting in Scripture. While lingering over an explicit line-by-line reading of an ancient striptease, Pastor Mark encouraged wives to be visually generous allies, to fight with and for their husbands by providing an archive of redeemed images. By couching the temptation to view porn in terms of everyday spiritual warfare, Driscoll created a sense of urgency while suturing wives' sexual freedom to their husbands' visual nature and reinstating women as the proper objects of the male gaze. Men's minds involuntarily file snapshots of beautiful women, and their file is filled with images that stretch all the way back to boyhood, and they show up without warning. Every time a guy sees a beautiful woman, it's a snapshot. Click, 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 click. It starts when he's a little boy and continues throughout his whole life. It's involuntary. It's how the man is made. The result is he has an ever-growing repository of pictures of beautiful women. They show up, right, random shuffle, without his even being prepared or aware of it. If you're married, on your way home, ask your husband. He'll confirm it. He could be sitting in traffic, driving home from work, and all of a sudden, boop, there's that gal who sat next to him in junior high. Hasn't seen her in a long time, but she's back. That file just came up. Many women don't understand this, but your husbands, if you're married, are in a war every moment of every day, as images come to them or old images are archived for them, and they have to decide what to do with them. In response, Driscoll advised wives to be sympathetic to your husband's temptations and talk openly to encourage and support him. Be a visually generous wife so he sees you as an ally on his team. Lights on or off? On, right? Lots of guys, on. Even guys who flunked out of school are going to pass this test, all right? Instead of fighting with him, fight for him, with lots of redeemed images. Let him see and then snapshot, snapshot, snapshot. In turn, Pastor Mark articulated this objectification of women's difference as a matter of gender equality. Ladies, don't judge men for being men. Don't judge your husband for being a dude. God made men and women equal but different. Your husband was made first, but that doesn't mean he was the beta version of a human being and that woman was the fully matured humanity. You live in a culture that encourages you, all of us, to sort of assume that women are superior to men, but they're not. The culture pressures men to sympathize, to empathize, to relate, to connect with the feminine, and that's all well and good so long as it goes both ways. Women should also try to understand all that makes men men, the visual nature of men, the sexual nature of men, the aggressive nature of men. Emphasis is placed on men's visual, sexual, and aggressive nature, while women's difference is performed through bodily labor that is at once sexualized and nurturing, both assertive and caring. Throughout Princess, Driscoll encouraged wives to be naked without shame in the marital bedroom while graphically depicting biblically ordained fantasies for global distribution. Although women were relegated to domesticated roles, according to Mars Hill's complementarian gender doctrine, which posits men and women as equal yet different, equally made in God's image but ordained with distinct roles, women were crucial to the production of biblical porn and played a critical role as producers themselves. Their sexual freedom worked on behalf of not only the marriages, but also the church. Driscoll succinctly summarized how crucial this woman's work was to the future of evangelical Christianity in a statement to a room full of men aspiring to found churches affiliated with the global church planting network he co-founded called Acts 29. Those who attended an Acts 29 boot camp in 2007 were told that by Driscoll that the church planter's wife has the most important job in a new church, having sex with the church planter. In this lecture, Driscoll also stated, "We hold masculine male leadership in the highest esteem, yet the church is almost completely effeminate in America. There's been a wholesale departure from masculine leadership in home and church. Women and children go to church, men do not, and those men who do go to church are effeminate, worthless men. Christianity is not doing well in this country. That is why young men in urban centers are attracted to Islam. They want a masculine religion, a powerful God, something that gives them truth and that calls them as a team." While same-sex attraction, fornication, and lust were all sexual sins women testified to at Mars Hill, it was the withholding of sex by wives from their husbands that was the most often highlighted. In a post entitled "Not Tonight, Honey, I Have a Headache," one contributor to a church blog called Reforming Femininity wrote, "Scriptures clearly states that men and women who are married are to have sex and have it regularly. We are not to deprive one another, and what's more, men and women's bodies belong to our spouses. Scripture does not command us as wives to desire our husband sexually at all times. It is not a sin for a woman to lack sexual desire for her husband. The point at which it becomes a sin is when a wife is unwilling to give her husband access to her sexually. This can lead to many problems, including bitterness, resentment, sexual temptation and frustration, and a lack of confidence in the husband. Make sex a priority, rearranging whatever in life is necessary until you have given it the proper place. Remember, it's a priority in God's eyes. An entire book of the Bible is devoted to it. Here's the hardest part. Do not deny your husband sexually." According to this doctrinal understanding, husbands and wives equally possess ownership of their spouse's bodies, but in access to said bodies, wives are more prone to sexual sin than their husbands. This anonymous contributor reiterates the biblical imperative preached by Driscoll that Christian wives prioritize sex in order to secure masculine leadership at home and in church. In addition to its ambitious and vibrant presentation on stage, The Peasant Princess was a Mars Hill milestone in other ways. First, the series was video streamed via satellite, syncing live in remote services such that the congregants across the church's campuses could text message questions in real time during post-sermon Q&A sessions, simulating connectivity and suggesting authenticity to those participating as viewers. Second, Driscoll's wife Grace joined him on stage for the first time during services. Her participation challenged the complementarian understanding that no woman could preach from the pulpit, but her presence on stage was justified by Driscoll's need for a woman's perspective. Thus, Pastor Mark's smoking hot wife, a phrase I often heard in reference to Grace, provided affective labor through both her feminine counsel and shape. After sermons, queries materialized like soundbite confessions to sexual fantasies and transgressions on screens throughout the sanctuary, confronting congregants with evidence of their sinful lusting while providing empirical proof of Pastor Mark's admonishments concerning their utter depravity. As they testified to the spiritual truth that Driscoll sexualized hermeneutic, members were constituted as both subjects and objects of shame and desire. A reverberation effect between the sermons and the questions that followed bolstered the legitimacy of Driscoll's spiritual authority and the authenticity of his exegesis, while manifesting a pornographic imaginary that figured congregants as both enslaved by and witnesses to sin. Ballard: should spouses confess to each other every time they sin visually or sexually? Downtown: what if my spouse cannot compare physically to the visual temptations of the world? Bellevue: would it be sinful to videotape my wife and I being intimate? Mars Hill's cultural production of biblical porn generated and exploited technologies of surveillance that fostered the desire to submit not only to Driscoll's authority, but also to the work of being watched. Congregants' affective labor during the Q&A sessions was simultaneously voluntary and non-intentional. The use of cell phones and flat screens normalized and habituated the act of public confession, while the service's content and performance mobilized a pornographic imaginary through which the biblical truth of Driscoll's hermeneutic and his audience's sinful nature were affirmed. At Mars Hill, conviction and confession were processed as and through social media to benefit the church's cultural influence and growing empire. Any visitor to the Mars Hill website was a few clicks away from Christian Sex Q&A mature content, where a warning box announcing that due to the overwhelming volume and explicit content of questions texted during the Princess series, the Driscolls would blog responses to certain queries. According to the MH17 rating that appeared in a black box above these inquiries, anyone under 17 was required to get adult permission before viewing them. Given the church's target audience was young men who were presumably pornographically challenged, this play on the NC-17 film rating appeared to be a tantalizing teenage joke rather than a serious attempt to warn readers. Under the MH-17 warning, the Driscolls blogged responses to questions such as, "Can I perform anal sex on my wife?" with advice that encouraged further research online. "Do your homework. Be careful. If your wife is willing, anal sex is technically permissible, but for a host of reasons may not be beneficial. We do not endorse everything on this website, but if you want to read some commentary on the issue from Christian married women, you can go to Christian Nymphos. Queries such as, my wife likes to masturbate me upon occasion and wants to know how to get better at it. What should she do? Or is it okay for me and my wife to masturbate ourselves if we are together and both turned on by it? Or is it okay for a spouse to masturbate himself or herself during the act of lovemaking? Were also answered with candid encouragement. Yes, the combination of masturbating during the act of lovemaking may physically heighten the degree of pleasure. For example, many wives cannot climax from normal intercourse, but can climax from the stimulation of their clitoris, which is not a point of contact during normal sexual intercourse. This can be pleasurable for both spouses, considering that most men are visual, and this could be a display of visual generosity for him. In their responses, the Driscolls encouraged mutual masturbation as a form of couples therapy that encouraged those seeking their advice to reach out and touch themselves through the church network. While flexing its phallic power online, Mars Hill promised marital orgasms as explosive as those procured with Viagra. Biblical porn was produced as a confessional discourse and surveillance technology that titillated and monitored audiences live and remote. A holy combination of sexual tease, biblical counsel, and sex education, biblical porn proliferated as and through popular culture every time porn was typed into a search engine. Thus, Driscoll's pornification of the pulpit was achieved not simply through sexualized exegesis, but entanglements of body and technology that commodified biblical porn as a social pornography of popular culture. A former congregant from a location out of Seattle blogged on how this dynamic affected his marriage. My wife started listening to the Peasant Princess series, and over the course of listening to it, showed some disturbing signs of paranoia. Driscoll tells women that sex is critical to a happy marriage, and unless they put out, they are allowing Satan to sleep between them and their husbands. He directs women to pleasure their men orally, pleasure them daily, and be submissive to their needs. My wife became insecure and fearful. She began having dreams about me cheating on her and began quietly checking up on me out of fear. It was as though she was worried about meeting Driscoll's expectation for her in our marriage more than my own. Mars Hill wives were convicted of their duty to embody free sex in order to combat demons and maintain fidelity within marriage. In turn, an atmosphere of spiritual warfare spread paranoia by proliferating invisible enemies at once satanic and technological. The various technologies employed by the church to promote paranoid conflations of freedom and control were not merely instruments but agents themselves. Bodies that inspired and exploited gendered yet collective affective labor in the cultural production of a pornographic imaginary that was mobile, autonomous, and infectious. My experience with how this paranoid dynamic played out on the ground cannot be summarized by the content of the workshops I attended on gender and sexuality or by the conversations I had with women at such events. Rather, it was something that I repeatedly noticed people noticing about me, but which remained unspoken. Soon after I began attending Mars Hill, it became readily apparent that my singleness mattered. I do not recall ever being asked if I was single, but it was a term often used within Mars Hill parlance, particularly when the topic concerns sexual sin. Abstinence workshops on maintaining maturity within singleness were specifically and only designed for women. My singleness was not an aberration, and it did not classify me as an outsider in the same way that my status as a non-Christian did. The first couple of questions asked of me in the briefest of encounters were whether or not I was a Christian and how long I had been attending Mars Hill, but I was never directly asked whether I was single. Instead, it was the lack of a wedding band that branded me. I came to expect furtive glances, downward glances to my ring finger, regardless of whether I was talking with a man or a woman. In a distinct manner I had never felt or encountered before, my lack of marital status ritually provoked an acute dis-ease. In order to learn more of the church's complementarian doctrine, I attended a woman's training day in January 2007 called Christian Womanhood in a Feminist Culture. Soon after my arrival, I spoke with a pregnant woman in her mid-20s who shared that she began attending Mars Hill 4 years prior after meeting her husband, who was already a member. During our conversation, she asked which of the breakout sessions I had signed up for. The first half of the day, we would all attend the same lectures as a group. Roughly 400 women were in attendance for this free event open to non-members. But while registering online, we were asked to choose 2 of 4 breakout sessions in the afternoon that addressed specific sin issues such as romanticism, or a sexually charged fantasy life inspired by the reading of too many romance novels and the viewing of too many Hollywood chick flicks, gluttony, modesty, and sexual sin. As we compared our notes on our choices, my companion said that she did not struggle with romanticism or sexual sin, but wanted to ensure that gluttony and modesty would not become problems post-marriage. She then mentioned a book she read for a Mars Hill class in which the author explained that, as she described it, if you are out at a restaurant and your husband sees a beautiful woman, the waitress, for example, even if they don't flirt or anything, he will remember her. My companion then glanced down, spied my naked ring finger, and said quietly, "Of course, I don't like thinking that way." I found myself blushing for no reason. Of the 8 women I shared lunch with that afternoon, I was the only single and the only one attending the romanticism and sexual sin sessions. In contrast to my lunchtime companions, every woman I spoke with in the physical and spiritual adultery session, there was a last-minute change in the title, was single. The room was packed, and within moments of sharing her testimony, the speaker, an elder's wife, was sobbing. She cried throughout her confession to sexual sins pre-marriage, teenage transgressions traced back to sexual abuse suffered as a child that she'd never confronted or even recounted until she sought biblical counseling for another seemingly unrelated issue. She also testified to experiencing physical, mental, and emotional exhaustion from taking on too much work in service to the church. This compulsion to always be available to help others, she confessed, was due to the feeling that it was the only way that she could finally feel worthy of being loved, especially by God. I listened as she repeatedly described herself as a whore, both sexually and spiritually, and sensed the entire room crying. At times, the collective weeping was so overwhelming that it was difficult to hear the speaker, even though she used a microphone and I was sitting in the center of the room. When I rejoined my lunchtime companions for the closing large group session in the sanctuary, they immediately asked in excited but hushed tones about what I had witnessed. In the few minutes it took me to find them, the emotionally raw testimony of the sexual sin session had become a buzz topic. When one of the women remarked that she was looking forward to listening to the adultery session after the audio recordings were uploaded to the Mars Hill website, I told her that I doubted that what I had just heard would be publicly shared online. It was too personal, I said. My companion did not reply, but simply looked at me, gently smiling. As we settled into our seats for a final prayer, it was announced that the audio recordings of all of the sessions would be accessible via Mars Hill's media library within a few weeks. I later discovered the sessions were not only available as audio downloads through the church's website, but also the iTunes podcast, Mars Hill Church Everything Audio, which included the full names of each speaker. Even as they were being taught to trust in God's grace and sovereignty, women were called on by the church and each other to habitually and publicly confess to sexual shame in the unending process of seeking repentance, challenging the misconception that they were not equal to men insofar as their capacities to sexually sin was concerned. By freely offering their sexual transgressions and sexualized bodies as signs and commodities through which to promote and animate biblical porn, women's voluntary labor contributed to its viral and visceral capacity to globally network affective, political, and economic value. Thank you very much.
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, sure. So the question basically was around Driscoll's education. Yes, he did, apparently. I mean, as far as I know, he graduated. And he had a degree in communication. And he did do also ministry. It was more online and by distance with a theological seminary in Portland. I can't remember the name. Western, thank you very much. So Western. So he did have education.
How about his wife? Did she have education, so far as you know?
Yes, she did. She also went to college. I can't remember where did Grace go?
Wazoo?
She also went to Wazoo.
She graduated? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I do not want, you know, Mark Driscoll is a smart man. You know, nothing in this book, I hope, comes across as being condescending or dismissive, because I was very taken with the way in which the production team, everything at Mars Hill ran very, very smoothly and was very, very well done. I mean, it had this huge following in Seattle because of that.
It sounds like a Cajun beat, you know? It's just hard to take it seriously for me.
Yeah, I took it really seriously. It had a profound effect on me. When I started going, I was actually doing my dissertation research as a doctoral candidate in anthropology on same-sex marriage politics, so on gay marriage in Seattle and the legalization thereof. I had no intention of doing a book about the church, none. So I was going to Mars Hill initially because I was interested, because Driscoll wasn't talking openly in an anti-gay marriage kind of way from his sermon, from the pulpit. There weren't protests, you know, that Mars Hill was organizing like other churches were doing in the area. So I was fascinated by, okay, what is this church saying about gay marriage at all? Because I wasn't finding anything initially. Then it just took a moment for me to figure out that this was a far more pernicious dynamic that was going on. It wasn't so, you know, pronounced in terms of a politically overt anti-gay stance, but it was, I mean, Mark's first sermon, it's not in this section, I guess, but in the introduction of the book, I talk about the first sermon I went to, and before the sermon begins, Mark is on stage talking about Talladega Nights with Will Ferrell in it, that movie, right? And there's that joke about little baby Jesus. Little baby Jesus, thank you for my smoking hot wife. So Mark said that joke and went like this on stage. Yeah, as though his wife was standing. I mean, she wasn't there physically, but he gestured as though she was there.
And this was before 2007?
This was a sermon 2006, fall. So, so that fascinated me, because here's this church talking very openly about sex at a time when sexual freedom wasn't something that was being bantered about in the gay marriage legalization,
this
right?
This is a weird church. Wasn't that understood from the get-go? I mean, this is going to be...
From whose get-go?
My get-go. Okay.
Fair.
I mean, Mars Hill, I love the name. I don't know what it means, but I love the name, but
it's from the Bible.
So Protestant, Episcopal, Catholic, Jewish, it's its own thing.
So it was an independent evangelical church, right? Which means it had its own governing body, right? It didn't have any sort of denominational oversight, as you just, you know, were referencing, basically. I would say that Driscoll's theology was very much his own. Now, and that's not to say, though, that, you know, there were pastors. I mean, there have been books written by Christian authors. For example, Tim LaHaye, if you know the Left Behind series, Tim LaHaye's series, Left Behind, it's published a while ago now, I guess in the 70s or 80s. But he wrote a series with his wife about sex that was pretty explicit, had some drawings in it and such. I mean, it's not so unique that a church would be talking about sex and sexual freedom within marriage, and within Christian marriage especially, being really good, right? But what I was fascinated by was, first of all, again, the ways that Mark would talk about this in terms of women's having to be particularly sexually free and the genderedness of that power dynamic. As well as the fact, again, the technologies aspect that comes out a bit in what I spoke to.
Well, the technology seems very modern, and the philosophy seems very regressive.
Mm.
It just, and particularly in a town like Seattle, it's just hard to believe that.
I'm not surprised it's in Seattle.
Okay, well, and then the last question, I'm sorry to keep talking, but was that the main focus of this church, or was there a main focus, peace in the world, or, you know, environmental, whatever the hell. I mean, what else did they talk about?
Growth. Church growth.
Money, in other words.
Multiple. Well, it wasn't prosperity gospel, but it was about replicating, multiplying facilities. That's where the labor went in. So one of the things that also was interesting to me when I first started attending is I noticed Mark would talk about tithes and talents. So if you can't give tithes, because again, lots of young people went to this church, a lot of college-age students went to this church, right? So so they don't have a lot of money. And he would openly recognize that, right? But he would say, but if you give your talents, then you're also giving to your church. And so that was, again, that's why labor is in my subtitle. So labor is thought about in very different ways throughout the book. And one of the ways that I think about the exploitation of labor is the exploitation of that volunteer labor, especially when people started becoming shunned and exiled when they would just simply speak up and say, you know, not even anything very divisive or dissent, or that's almost too strong a word, but just say something that could be construed as not resonant with what Mark was preaching or what Mark's vision for the church was or whatever. Then people might get called out for that, or, you know, women would get labeled gossips, men would be labeled wolves, you know.
I love being a gossip. Big deal. But anyway, so...
I think there's probably more questions. Yeah. Okay, sorry. I do want to move around the room. Thank you, though. I appreciate your engagement. Lynn, yeah.
Yeah, so I was really interested in your description at the beginning of your response to the video. And I was really curious, do you view that, your experience, as sort of an illustration of exactly what was going on in the church, that there's this sort of attachment to this man, that he's just... charismatic in every sense of the word.
So
could you just say more about that?
Sure. So the question was about why, you know, start the book the way that I did. Was that resonant to my mind with other people's experiences and their attraction? I would say their affective attachments to Mark. So I use affect to steer away from charisma, because charisma is so much about the individual and the individual's authority. And while certainly, again, everything I'm speaking to does certainly, has an authoritarian kind of tone to it, no question. But I wouldn't say that Mark was simply charismatic and that was it. You know, again, there were so many different kinds of relationships that developed through the church, right? But in relationship to my actual story that I began with, yes. I mean, I do feel as though, like I mentioned, it was from the time that I started attending in 2006. And my life happened, you know. Like, that's the other part of this story that I think is really cool. And it comes out a little bit in that little bit that I read to you, but I flesh it out a little bit more in the intro. As I had, you know, I finished my dissertation in 2010. Again, I did not write my dissertation on this. I started a whole new project, basically, right? So I had all these notes, I had all these experiences, but then I had to have a job. So I moved to Miami for a job, and then, you know, it fell apart. Within 3 months, I was basically told, well, we don't have that job for you anymore that we promised you for longer. Welcome to the Academy today. So then I was basically, I had to find work again, and I was fortunate enough and had people pulling for me so that I could come back to Seattle. Now, again, I had no idea what was going to happen. I was thinking about the church. I was writing about the church at that time, and I knew that I wanted to develop this book. But basically, that's when 2012 was when Joyful Exiles, that was the first website that I saw that had posted, Paul Petrie was the pastor that was shunned. That was this big event. It comes up in my second chapter, so I won't detail it too much. But there's, you know, there's ways through which my own story and my own sense of God's hand, it had a visceral impact on me, because I don't want to use the language of exceptionalism. There are other people writing books about Mars Hill, and it's, you know, everybody has stories to tell, and that's great. But in my case, I did not expect to be here. I did not know things would be falling apart the way that they did. I did not know that I would get the kind of access to people that I wound up getting by their own, you know, willingness to really take risks in speaking with me. So that the risk and vulnerability are two components that I speak to and throughout the book, I would argue as well, because I think that those are really important to keep in mind. And then in terms of conviction, so my process of coming under conviction, as I talked to it about it in this presentation, was something that I think I realized in that moment was something that could be very easily manipulated and exploited. And that was really troubling to me. And that compelled me to reach out. You know, I mean, and there's a long story about why I didn't have access to people to begin with. I had to get Mark's permission to talk to anybody at the church because of IRB, the International Institutional Review Board for Human Subjects. So I didn't have permission to talk to people until later when things started falling apart. Then the review board's like, oh, yeah, sure, he's almost gone and everything's falling apart. Talk to people. You know, it's kind of, it's just the logic there. But anyway, institutional logic in general is not something I grok very well.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Jessica Johnson is the author of Biblical Porn, Affect, Labor, and Pastor Mark Driscoll's Evangelical Empire. She teaches in the departments of Anthropology and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Washington. She spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on May 23rd. Thanks to KUOW's Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. And catch up with other great Seattle area talks by subscribing to our podcast. Tune in again soon.